Welcome to the Super Gamer Podcast. Welcome to the new Super Gamer Podcast, episode 88. Our guest this week is, he's been writing about video games for more than 20 years, runs the HardcoreGaming101.net website, Castlevania Dungeon, which we will bring up. There's a podcast, the top 47,858 games of all time, publishes books, is an author, writes fan fiction, is somewhat known as Disco Alucard, but we have Kurt Kalata here. Thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Yeah. So, we'll start with Castlevania Dungeon, because that's kind of how this interview, where I was like, oh, I gotta get him on right now, is because you just made an update to the site for the first time in, like, 10 years. Reading the update, though, it's sort of, you kind of say, like, well, it's been a long time, and I'm really proud of this site, but I want to keep it as a relic of the old days of the internet. So I'm kind of wondering, like, is there going to be new content, or is it you just telling everyone that it's going to be there?
Probably not. It's probably not going to be a whole lot. It's sort of like to me, this is something that I worked on through most of like my high school and college days. And going back and reading of it, it's, yeah, like kind of embarrassing, some of the writing. Some of it's not necessarily bad, but very juvenile. But some of it is also just like dated for a very specific time period. Like in the context of Castlevania, we were, you know, all excited when Circle of the Moon and Harmony of Dissonance came out. And, you know, in retrospect, those weren't quite as good, especially when later games came out. But like when I started publishing books, the Castlevania one wasn't the first one we did, but it was one of the first ones we did. And that was always meant to be like the Castlevania Dungeon in book form. But I went over so much of it, and I'm like, I can't publish this. This is just way too high school writing style. So I went back and revised a whole lot of it, and that's what the book is. And as far as like technically we could go and integrate that to the site, but it takes a lot of work, and it is like, fan sites like that used to be everywhere, especially in the late 90s. Like, that was the sort of places that I hung out all the time. And they don't really exist so much anymore. Like, you'll find blogs every once and again, or some other old school, like, RPG site that's still around. But I guess people don't really do them that much. I mean, everything is run through, like, WordPress. You have all these wikis that are kind of corporate in a way that rubs me the wrong way, but they are useful for the sort of stuff the Castlevania Dungeon used to serve like 15, 20 years ago. So I would kind of just rather leave it as a museum, because, you know, I've gotten older and getting nostalgic for certain things, you know, places that don't exist both offline and off. One of the people that administrated the site did want to redo it a little bit, but I'm like, I don't know. I'd rather kind of just keep it the way it is.
Right, yeah, I was going through your site, it reminded me of the old walkthroughs, which you can still find, but as you said, like, a lot of walkthroughs now are just sort of in a wiki format, but for my money, if it doesn't start with an ASCII image, I don't want to see it.
Yeah, that's a lost art.
Yeah, and funny enough, one I came across while researching you, it said there's an FAQ, and it was like, for the latest version, go to our site, GeoCities, blah, blah, blah. Like, wow, the latest version is pretty old.
That was certainly a 1998 era message. We weren't even on GeoCities that long. Because, like, most of us started off either on a free web server. Because even back then, like, for a while, ISPs would give you, like, free web space. And that even predated that. So the Castlevania Dungeon was cobbled between a couple of those that me and one of my friends had signed up for. But back then, GameSpy, which I think back then was mostly for finding matches for multiplayer games, they were starting up an actual website. And so somebody who worked there got together a bunch of, like, even back then, writing about Castlevania was sort of like a retro video game series, because the PlayStation was the new hotness, and stuff from 8 years ago was just seen as impossibly old. Hold on a second. Sorry, my phone went off. If it was somebody important, I had to answer, but it's just...
Oh, no problem. What song was that that your cell phone is?
Oh, it's East 3, the Tigray Mind theme.
Okay.
It's like one of my favorite video game music tracks, so it's always on my cell phone.
Nice. Pretty recently, I believe, were on Retronauts talking about Castlevania and ranking all the best ones, or all of them, really, where they fall.
Yep.
My own, easy, my number one is Symphony of the Night. And I loved going through your site for that section because even though I think I know the game pretty well, there were a bunch of weapons that I was like, I didn't know this existed.
That's why I love that game. Like, for such a long time, there were so many, like, weird little details that I would just stumble upon, like, every time I would play and find something strange. And even now, like, there's, like, some sort of weird little tidbit that I find, like, on the cutting room floor that I never knew about. It's like, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah,
that's kind of one of the reasons that I still prefer it over the GBA and the DS games, because like they were made with a lot of care, but they didn't seem to quite have the budget that Symphony of the Night did. Because Symphony of the Night was just like them trying to jam in as much as possible under the deadline. I think the DS ones were a little bit more scheduled; like they needed to come out every year, so they didn't quite have that level of polish.
Mm. And I'd never heard of Grimoire of Souls, and being Canadian myself, I find it very odd that they would only release it here.
I don't understand mobile strategy at all. Like they did list it on the American Google Play site, but it would never work on my phone, so I thought it was something with my phone. And I sideloaded it, didn't work at all. And then I didn't find out later, like, yeah, it was only officially launched in Canada and some other territories before they scuttled it before it even went wide, so I guess it must have failed. They brought it back to Apple Arcade, which is again a platform I can't play on because I don't have any of the hardware and don't feel like spending the money to get it.
Fair enough. You also made the Contra HQ, which I think is older than Castlevania Dungeon.
It's newer, but it definitely never updated the same way. So at least the Castlevania Dungeon was updated up until Lords of Shadow came out. So that was like 2010, 2011. And the last time Contra HQ, I just need to look this up because I had also forgotten, was when Contra 4 came out. And that was like 2007, 2008. But yeah, that came about because at a certain period of time, like I had just written about as much as Castlevania as I could back then. That was maybe in the period between Symphony of the Night and Castlevania 64. So like, I was going to do something different. And as it turns out, there's not really as much you can write about Contra as there is about Castlevania. And there was never quite as many games either. Like they would bring it back every once and again and just kind of peter out.
Is it fair to say Konami is your favorite gaming company?
Yeah, they put out a lot of great stuff. I mean, like recently over the past decade, I haven't really followed their stuff too much. Because there's a Contra game that came out that I bought, but everybody universally seems to say it's bad. that RuneCore game. And, you know, Castlevania, is like, they've supported it in a way, especially with all the retro re-releases. But I kind of, like, burnt out on Metal Gear Solid and Silent Hill, which are the other series that I really like back in the, especially the PlayStation 2 days.
Right.
Yeah, like, their shoot-em-up series, because we, you know, I put out a whole book on Konami shoot-em-ups, like, you know, Gradius and Life Force and Twinbee and, you know, all that stuff I absolutely loved. So we'll do another Konami game, book eventually. Once we get some Silent Hill. Silent Hill we're posting right now, and we're working on Metal Gear, so that'll get done someday.
You started putting out books 10 years ago. I think May of this year was the 10th anniversary of your first book, Guide to Classic Graphic Adventures.
Yep.
And that one came in at about 760 pages.
Yep.
Which you still felt you could have covered much more. You know, at what point do you say, okay, I can't do it anymore, like, or what leads to you going, all right, 760 is where we stop?
For that book specifically, there's an upper limit, Amazon's self-publishing service at 828. So that is automatically going to set as a hard limit. There's also pricing, because they price out things by pages, so it can't go too high. And also at a certain point, you just need to say, I'm done. This needs to get out the door. And that process, that has to start several months beforehand, because even when you write 760 pages of a Word document, that all needs to be edited, and that always takes much longer than you would expect it to do. And also, I think at a certain point, my wife was like, all right, you just have to finish it up. I'm like, yeah, you're right. So, let's keep me honest. And you know, that was one of my first times actually, like, managing a product, you know, and making sure the scope doesn't get out of control. Because even when I was looking at it, like it only covers adventure games for a period of like 20 years, from like 1980 to about 2000 was where we set the thing. And that was not only just to keep things manageable, but also because like after then I kind of fell off the adventure game series. Like they weren't really being made for me anymore. So I could just focus on the stuff that I wanted to write about. And I think that a lot of the classic adventure game scene was kind of the same way.
One thing I like that you've written about as far as that book is, you know, you said you had to cover the Sierra, you had to cover LucasArts, and, you know, obviously, but you were also getting a lot of people saying, well, you got to do this, and this game's just as good as Myst, and blah, 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 and then you'd play them, and you were like, no, it's not.
Yeah, like I never liked Myst, even back then. I know it was hugely popular, but for the sort of games that I liked, it had, like, basically none of it. And those games became really popular through the mid and late 90s, and even up through the 2000s. And there were a couple games I played that were better than I had expected them to be, but not many of them. And there were just a ton of those, and they've just kind of fallen to the gap of time. And you know, maybe somebody who has more appreciation of them can dig them up and explain them, but that person can't be me.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Do you feel like do you not want to write about games you don't like? Do you think maybe, like, well, as you just said, like, it might just be personal taste and I don't want to do them a disservice, or does that matter?
It's a line, I think, because, you know, writing about things professionally, like, sometimes, okay, you need to set, like, we need to cover these specific games in order to be comprehensive, but I might not necessarily like them that much. And usually if that happens, then I try to find, like, a freelancer or somebody who has a better appreciation for it. Can't always, like, that's not always possible. And sometimes it's not necessarily that I dislike them so much as I would rather write about something else, and this particular series is too exhausting. Like, the Beat 'em Up book, which was, we put out a couple months ago, and that would have been out several years earlier if it wasn't for the Kunio series, which there's just so many of them. So many of them were Japanese only. And it could just get overwhelming trying to keep track of, like, 20 games worth of history and mechanical evolution. And it's seen kind of a rebirth lately, especially with River City Girls coming out, which did very well, is my understanding. So that is one of the things that kind of helped pull together, like, my interest in that and going back and playing all those games. And also 3DS emulation ended up being improving, because there's a couple of games that were, like, very difficult to play because of 3DS region locking. Approaching it just from, like, I guess the difference between an amateur and a professional is you need to, like, okay, I need to do this. I might not personally be super enthusiastic, but I still need to be able to address it without being, like I can't be mean about it. Like, that's doing a service to nobody. Yeah, being able to like, write about stuff they don't necessarily love is a skill you need to learn.
Can you think of what would be the worst game you've had to play start to finish in the name of research?
As far as a game that just a personal vendetta against, there's a game called Congo Bongo.
Okay.
Which, it's not, like, you know, a super vicious game, but it's one of the first Sega games I ever played, and I absolutely hate it. Like, it's an isometric, it's basically Donkey Kong from an isometric perspective. And it's, like, that game and Zaxxon was another one. Like, those sort of, those are very much in the style in the early 80s. And I was never able to wrap my head around them back then. I can barely wrap my head around them now. But I was doing a Sega book on, like, these games, especially Zaxxon. That was one of Sega's earliest hits. Like, we need to write about it eventually. So it took a while because I would keep putting it off and putting it off. But at a certain point, it needed to get done. So it did.
What's your beef with the Souls series?
I don't hate it. Demon's Souls, I played, like, you know, like, From Software had a reputation of putting out lots of janky stuff, and I never really touched them that much. But Demon's Souls, even back then, was a real cult hit. And I played it, and I just got annoyed about it. Like, I would keep falling off of cliffs and then having to go back to, like, an earlier point. I'm like, this is not the game that I was led to believe it was. But I just kind of, like, pieced out of it. And then Dark Souls came out, and that was the one that became, like, the mainstream hit. But because of my experience with Demon's Souls, I was like, yeah, I don't know. And there's all that discourse surrounding the difficulty around it. And I like difficult games, but only certain types of difficult games. Like, I can go just fine with, like, a Castlevania or, like, a Ninja Gaiden or any of those sort of games. Even Metroid Dread, like, people complain about the difficulty, and I thought that was, like, perfectly fine, but that's just because of the way it's constructed. Like, you can play as much times as you want, you can respawn pretty quickly, you might die a lot, but you're always getting in there. Like, there's always, like, kind of a forward momentum. Whereas, this is my impression just from learning about Dark Souls, is that every time you died, you would have to retread a whole bunch of ground.
Right.
And you would just keep dying at bosses, and, you know, you may gain skills over that time period, but I was like, you know what, I am too old for this. Like, there are so many other games that I would rather play than spending, you know, even like 10-20 hours just on this specific game. The only one I did play was Bloodborne, which I liked, but again, like, I got to the first boss and was never able to beat him. I'm like, I'll just go play something else.
Right. I'm certainly also of an age where I can appreciate, like, I'm not banging my head against the wall here. I got other stuff to do.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I should probably go back and play Dark Souls just for the, I guess, the educational thing, because the Dark Souls and all those have, they've influenced so many games. And I only know about it, like, informationally. Like, I've only kind of experienced it firsthand. So I'd like to do that just for that perspective, but it's not something I've necessarily sit down and devote, like, a month to try to beat.
Right. Funny enough, my friend and I, who ended up being my roommate for a good while, we got Demon's Souls because we heard it was so hard, and I guess at the time we thought it was, you know, showing our how good we are at games or something. But it's certainly, I'm sure you've probably heard from people, like, it's punishing, but there's, you know, when you kind of get the formula, like, there are definitely harder games out there. There are games that I could not beat, and that's not one of them, you know? Like,
yeah, I'm sure if I actually, like, sat down and really, like gave it a proper chance, like, there's a lot of the discourse around it that was like, it's incredibly hard, and it may or may not actually be that way. I don't know. Again, I'll get to it someday.
Your podcast, the top 47,858 games of all time. Is there a reason for that number? Is that, like, the number of video games that are out in the world, or why that?
So that was conceptualized by the podcast producer Xerxes, and I think at the time he created the podcast, that's how many entries were on Moby Games at the time. So Moby Games, of course, has expanded considerably since then, and there have been a ton of games that have been released in the past, I don't know, 5-6 years, so I'm sure that number has grown substantially, but that was the story he told me, so I'll repeat it now.
How do you, I mean, I guess the idea is it's never-ending, like, you're literally just going to play a new, or talk about a different game every time? Is there a type of game you want to talk about?
It's all user-nominated. listeners will, they'll, if they give us a good review on whatever platforms are currently available at the moment, then they get nominated and then they get put on a list, and then eventually we get together and talk about it. And the idea is that over the course of several years, you just have this huge Frankenstein of a list. And of course, like, where they actually fall independently depends on who is available at that time to record it. So there's some people that like certain types of games, so they'll be more willing to rep it a little bit harder. I know I tend to be on any Sega Master System game episode, so I will always go to bat for those. We have a good contingent of Master System fans, so we can sort of argue down the Master System haters.
I will say it till I'm blue in the face. The whole Ghouls and Ghosts, Ghosts and Goblins series, whatever, none of them have ever come close to being as good as the Master System one.
It's a surprisingly good port.
It's awesome. Like, I play, you know, I own the Super Nintendo one, and like, I don't even really want to play it because I remember the Master System one. I'm like, that's just so much better.
Yeah, and it's shocking, too, because those versions were all, like, low-rent versions of them. Like, I picked up the version of Mercs of the Master System. It's terrible. The Strider version Master System, complete garbage. Ghouls and Ghosts, incredibly good. I don't know how it worked out like that.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, because my brother, who was older than me, he had the Master System when I was a kid. And Ghouls and Ghosts loved, Gangster Town loved, Shinobi was awesome, and Castle of Illusion. Those would be the ones that, like, really stick out to me.
It was my first video game system that was actually mine. I got when I was 5 years old from a relative. So I have fond memories of, like, Black Belt and Alex Kidd in Miracle World and even Alex Kidd in Lost Stars. And Wonder Boy 3 in particular was just like my absolute favorite. It was the last game that we got before we finally just threw in the towel and bought a Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems to be very well loved, especially in Europe and all those other countries where the Master System is more popular.
Actually, as far as your podcast, going along the lines of what's difficult and what I can't beat, you recently did Don't Starve, and that is one that, like, I can't come close to... Is there an end? I have no idea. Like, I die immediately. I like it, but I don't really know where to go from, like... it just dies so quick.
That one, I've never played, and I still have to... I haven't even listened to that episode of the podcast yet.
Okay.
But there was a... I work in my day job in, like, the insurance industry, and it's very rare that I meet anybody that plays video games, especially the type that I play. We did find some interns that they were like, yeah, Don't Starve, that's a cool game. I'm like, okay, I'll play it someday.
So back in July of this year, along with Bitmap Books, you published a 652-page book on Japanese RPGs. Demand for it was so massive, it sold out in 4 days, and now reprints have finally arrived, so people can order it again. You're telling people get them now, because if you want them later, it's going to be a while before there's another reprint.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the specifics because, you know, it's run by the publisher, so I don't know how many copies they printed or how many they've even sold at the moment. I do know that in general, the pandemic has still caused a lot of supply issues, especially in Europe, which is where they're located. So as far as, you know, if this run sells out, when they're going to get back, who knows? Especially, they only sell physical copies, too. Like, you can't get a digital one unless you buy a physical copy, then they'll give a PDF. So it's sort of a, if you want it, you should probably get it. Well, this applies to like every book. Like, I've been following a lot of manga for the past year, and again, like, if they sell out, when it'll get reprinted is kind of knows.
Well, with the size of this book, maybe it's a good thing there's no digital, because I believe I read for your first one, the 760-page one, for the Kindle edition, you had to compress it so much because Amazon cuts into your profit the bigger the file size. And at 96 megs, you actually would have been paying if people were to buy the book.
Yeah, that's kind of bullshit on Amazon's part. There's two ways that they structure the royalties. Is that either they give you, I'm trying to remember, I think it's 70%, but they charge you per megabyte, or you can just do flat 35%. So most of the books that we put out nowadays, they're considered like comic books, and that they're like basically just image files of each of the books instead of just like a Word document. And of course, those file sizes end up being like 200, 300 megs in size, even when they're compressed. So for that, there's no possible way that we could do the 70%. We have to do the 35 one, which isn't great, but Amazon is really the only horse in town, so you kind of have to go with what they want.
Mm-hmm. Well, what a lot of your books, after that first one, you went to a much smaller, you know, up to maybe 200 pages kind of style. What was it that brought you back for the Japanese RPGs one? Why are you now back at 650?
how do I say that? Well, so I had experience like it was a lot of fun putting the adventure game book, but it did take a long time to edit and put together. So after that, like, well, if we need to get these out at a reasonable rate, we can't do anything that massive. But with Bitmap Books, like, so it's like they're a small publisher, but they do have more support. They have, you know, the copy editors that can help look over and review things, and also, they're able to put out hardcover books. The quality of the stuff is much, 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 much better than what Amazon's print-on-demand is. So there's kind of more value in doing something that was that big and also full of full-color pictures and stuff like that. So basically, it's just, you know, more of a support network. But again, we still ran into the same problem. They're like, okay, we have 650 pages that we need to copy edit, which took a number of months between me, the publisher, and copy editor and a couple other people that we had just kind of fact-checking it. Right. So, again, when you're writing stuff, you're like, yeah, hell yeah, this is going to be amazing. And then the editing process is just complete drudgery. Like, why did I write so much?
The second draft is always the hardest.
Oh, yeah.
You're currently working on an indie game book?
Yeah, it's actually just a follow-up to
right.
A previous one that we did.
Right.
It's kind of just more of that.
So would that be the case, a case of, well, we couldn't fit it all in the first one?
Yes, and also that they put out so many indie books, indie games nowadays. And the first indie book is probably the weakest seller of any of the books we've done. Like, I don't pay attention to sales figures too much. Since it is print on demand, we don't have to worry about spending a whole lot of money getting things out there outside of just like the general cost of, you know, paying people to do the cover and the articles and things like that. But we still wanted to do it because A, I liked it, and B, like the Switch in particular has kept the indie market going even more. And there's still a lot of great stuff that's still coming out there. Like, even then, the list that I had created for this initially ended up being a lot different from what would actually published, just because, you know, I was working with another editor to try to funnel everything together. And they're even like right now, there's so many other things that we could fit in a volume 3 if we were to just do the cutoff list of today. I think it still is a good service to readers. Like, it's not like digging into obscure history or anything like that, but it's a good like buyer's guide.
Mm-hmm. You may or may not have an email. Well, you have the email, but it may or may not contain the first use of the term Metroidvania from 2003.
Oh, yeah. We discovered that that probably isn't the first one, but it does show that the term was in use back then. Because one of the other, you know, like game researchers, Kate Weller, she had been looking into the origins of this term. Because it tends to be credited to Jeremy Parrish, because he has a website about them. And he keeps saying, no, it's not me. I didn't. This is
right,
just,
I saw that.
Yeah. And the general consensus is, like, I'm just kind of going by my own memory that did pop up in the forums. It was just kind of a casually used word. It was just used to describe like any of the post Symphony of the Night games. But like, those sort of games outside of like Metroid Fusion and Zero Mission, for a long time, those are the only types of those games that were being made. And it wasn't until like Steam started getting big and then the indie market started exploding that all these people wanted to make those games because they weren't really being made anymore. And there was a label that was already there to describe them. So it just kind of ended up getting transplanted onto that. But yeah, the term had been around for a long time. Kate was asking to look into the old Castlevania Dungeon forums, but none of that stuff was really preserved.
Right.
But I was lucky, like, when I was in college, like, I did a sort of mailbag. There was another website that was really popular in the late 90s was the Gaming Intelligence Agency. And the mailbag was one of my favorite columns there. So I was like, well, there's not a whole lot I can update the Castlevania Dungeon right now, but this is sort of fun. But that ended up, in retrospect, being a pretty good idea because it does, like, capture what the discourse around these games were 20 years ago in a way that, like, forums disappear all the time. They aren't necessarily preserved. Like, Discord, all that stuff is going to be lost to time. Social media, like technically posts are preserved, but they're impossible to search. So that ended up being, again, like a pretty good idea. As I get older, like I'm sort of realizing the stuff, like, and maybe I shouldn't have deleted this stuff that when I was a teenager I thought would be useless, because it could have meant something like 20 some years later, you know?
Right. Well, like I told you before we started here, my computer blue screened. And I mean, the hard drive's okay, which is good. But I started thinking, like, oh, I haven't backed up, like, all these old podcasts. And, like, who cares, really? But, like, also, that's a lot of work that's just gone.
Yeah. I mean, I every time I get a new computer, I copy everything over outside of, like, you know, the Windows subdirectory or whatever. Just so I have it. So I still have files going back from college. I mean, I still have some, like, old email addresses, except for my college one, which they deleted without telling me. Which I was annoyed about.
And before we get off the Metroidvania thing, I do like that you pointed out sort of how the term obviously had to grow, I guess, become more of a household thing, because the person who sent you that email put Metroid-VVania, right? And now we just know it as a Metroid, like it's a single word kind of thing. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. As it turns out, like, Kate had been researching old Electronic Gaming Monthlies, and she had found that the style that was being used back then was also with the dash. But again, you know, somebody at some point probably realized that looked a little silly because it's not Castle Dash Vania, it's Castlevania.
Right.
So that just became how it was used. And now it's it was adopted by the Japanese fan base too. There's a Metroidvania Japanese Wikipedia article that explains about what it is, because it was a genre that, even though it kind of was created amongst Japanese developers, they were never that popular compared to how they were over here. So we've sort of helped propagate that style.
Has there been a difference in the way fans interact with your sites, or how they send mail? Or I'm not wording it very well, but like from what you used to get back in the day to how people interact with you now, like has that changed?
I mean, in the late 90s, getting an email was a like cause for celebration. Like, oh my God, somebody's contacted me. That's great. And of course, nowadays, email is so integrated in our life that anytime it's like, ah, it's more work. I mean, yeah, it's mostly on social media. It's just easier to talk to people there. That's how I guess I get most of the interaction. Because my site has a Discord and forums, but I tend not to go there too much just because of just always busy and juggling so many other things.
Mm-hmm. Anything you want to plug before we wind down here?
Okay, let's see now. Yeah, Japanese RPG book was reprinted. In addition to the retro indie book, we're sort of putting out another, it's a smaller format book that's mostly concentrated on Metroid, but also Kid Icarus and Punch-Out and a whole bunch of other more obscure Nintendo-themed games. That was, again, something that had been in the work for a while, but once they announced Metroid Dread earlier in the year, like, okay, we got to get this out, because Metroid Dread ended up being fantastic. But that's almost done. There's a couple pages that I need to finish up and then have it edited, and the cover is still being worked on, so that's something hopefully get out before the end of the year, but we'll see.
Awesome. Well, people should get on while they can. A Guide to Japanese Role-Playing Games, and pay attention for more books coming out. HardcoreGaming101.net, CastlevaniaDungeon.net. Kurt Kalata, thank you for being here.
Yes, thanks for having me again.